Howdy, and welcome to The Stoop. I'm Cutter Gonzalez, your host, and I am so excited to share this episode with you. Dan Reed, our first ever guest on the show, is such a special kind of person. Dan is the kind of person who combines smarts and know-how with unimpeachable moral clarity and wraps it all up in compelling stories. Dan absolutely knows their why, and they bring it with them in all that they do. Here's a little bit about Dan and their background. Dan is Greater Washington's Regional Policy Director, where they focus on housing and land use policy in Maryland and Northern Virginia. Before that, Dan was a transportation planner working with communities all over North America to make their streets safer, enjoyable, and equitable. Their writing has appeared in publications including Washingtonian, City Lab, and Shelter Force, as well as Just Up the Pike, a neighborhood blog founded in 2006. Dan received a Master of City Planning degree from the University of Pennsylvania, as well as a Bachelor of Science in Architecture and a Bachelor of Arts in English from the University of Maryland. Dan lives in Silver Spring, Maryland with Drizzy, their rescued pit bull mix, and occasionally fosters other dogs. I will also add that Dan was a foundational force in the creation of the Welcoming Neighbors Network, and one of the first folks I got to talk with when I joined the coordinating team. Dan has so much to teach us about the importance of building relationships, having a thoughtful strategy, how to do the day-to-day of advocacy, and the role networks like the Welcoming Neighbors Network can play in supporting housing advocates, including you. So let's get to it. Hey, Dan. Thanks for coming. So glad to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so happy to. When we were talking on the Welcoming Neighbors Network coordinating team about who we should have for our first episode, it was a pretty unanimous, like, Dan. Of course, Dan. So you were the obvious first choice, and I'm so glad because you're just so lovely to talk to. We talked when I first got hired, and that was such like, oh my goodness, maybe I can do this, you know?
I try.
Yeah, well, you know how it is when you first start, you're drinking from the fire hose, and you're like, oh my gosh, that kind of thing can be really overwhelming.
Yeah, especially, you know, you're working with folks all over the country too. Like that's a lot of stuff.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I've got work in probably 10 different states this week, and coordinating that can be a lot. Luckily, I have great colleagues on the team too, who made sure that I was never too overwhelmed. And they're just phenomenal. All people you know very well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, really broadly, I would just love to hear what's your housing story? Like, how did you get into this work? I know you've been involved since like high school.
Yeah. So, we moved around a lot as a kid. My mom went back to college shortly after I was born. And so, you know, I've never lived anywhere more than a couple of years. And one of my sort of recurring memories as a kid was looking for the next place to live, whether it was a different apartment complex or moving to a different part of, you know, it was all in suburban Maryland, but like a different part of the area, changing schools a lot. And the through line was, you know, my mom and later my stepfather wanted to buy a house, and their search for a home to buy, which took up like most of my childhood until they finally bought the house they live in now when I was 11, was sort of a major motivating factor for me. I saw how difficult it was for them. And when I was 15, in the neighborhood where he'd moved, where I went to high school, there was a sign for a proposal for a new housing development that I'd walk by this vacant lot every day on the way home from the school bus. And, you know, I heard some of the adults in the neighborhood talking about it, and folks were very opposed to it for a variety of reasons. It just didn't sit right with me because I knew how hard it had been for my own family to save up to afford a home, to find a home they could afford. You know, we ended up moving out of the neighborhood I'd lived in as a little kid as a result. You could say we were priced out. And I felt really strongly that I wanted other people to have the opportunity that we had, right? There was no word for this yet. This was in 2003, 2004. There certainly weren't any kids in my high school who were talking about this stuff or interested in this stuff. So it was a little isolating, but that was, I figured out, you know, how to go to the Montgomery County Planning Board and testify at a public hearing. I wrote a speech. I had spent, weeks sort of talking to my neighbors at like the park and, going to people's houses and sitting in their living rooms and trying to make the case for this. I went to this public hearing. I said my part. I got up and I turned around, and it was as if the entire neighborhood was just like glaring at me, like daggers in their eyes. And it felt sort of strangely empowering. If this is the worst they can do, right? And that was 20 years ago last month.
Wow. That's a longer legacy in the space than I think most people have. 'Cause I mean, there's this kind of this initial like sense that housing has entered the national consciousness. You have like both major party presidential candidates talking about it seriously, some with better or worse proposals, and different takes on the issue. But like I think this is the first time in my life, I'm almost 30, that I've heard presidential candidates talk about it in any way that wasn't just like about home loans. It's talking about supply. So that's all that to say that like that's a long time, way before this became popular to talk about, and before there was like a YIMBY movement, quote unquote, to be involved in that. And that story is just so, I mean, that connection is so intimate. It makes sense.
Yeah, it is really remarkable to see how the movement, as I call it, has grown over the past, 10, 15, 20 years. And I think it's really because things have gotten that bad, right? This is not just a working class issue. This is not just a coastal issue. This is impacting people all over the United States. And so not only do I think broadly, people, including those in leadership roles, are seeing how people are struggling, but there is increasingly an agreement about what the solutions are, right? When I was 15, the arguments to be made for why there should be 14 houses on the vacant lot in my parents' neighborhood were about like, it'd be bad for it's a way to discourage suburban sprawl, and if they live further up, there'll be more traffic, and less so about we have a housing shortage, right? That was not part of the language 20 years ago. In fact, it was the opposite, right? During the housing boom, the perception was we were building too many houses, and that's why there was the we were making it we were building too many houses, we're giving out too many loans, and we overcorrected so dramatically from that after the Great Recession, that we created a whole new problem.
Yeah, I mean, my personal story, very different at a young age, being in Texas. I'm based in Austin now, but I was born in Houston and lived there through elementary school, and then moved to New Braunfels, just north of San Antonio. And my parents were fortunate to own a house in Houston, and then it was 2006 when we moved to New Braunfels, which is right before that recession, and the house in New Braunfels bankrupted then, And then by the time I got to where I was looking at finding a home, I'm almost 30. At this point, they had owned their home. I was like, that's not even on the table for me. It's a totally different scenario. And that's in Texas, which I think for a long time had been fairly permissive about building. But then when it came time for me to come of age and our kind of cohort to grow into this space, there was just nothing. And especially where we wanted to live, right? Like I could live out in Buda or Kyle, south of Austin, but I wanted to live somewhere near my friends and near the amenities that drew me to urban life in general. And that was like not allowed until very recently. Austin has definitely turned a corner on that for sure. But I really want to know about kind of your work in Maryland because it's so interesting. I believe you did a lot of work in your capacity with Greater Washington and tons of like relationship building institutionally with administrators, that kind of stuff. And if you could just like walk us through what that story was from like inception to actually winning, because you did win.
Yeah. So I, as an organization, we like to say at Greater Washington that we work on this base of relationships, right? Like we started out as a volunteer-run blog, and over time, started building out advocacy work starting in 2015. We've been around since 2008, and so much of what we do is about building relationships with people, whether it's through social events, whether it's through Folks who came to the blog because they were interested in this stuff and they then went into careers in urban planning, that sort of when I came into this role professionally 2 years ago, I already sort of knew a few folks at the state level in Maryland who had been elected delegate and were starting to work their way up the ranks. And naturally, the first few months in my job, and this is the summer of 2022, that led to conversations about, well, what do we do about it? I'd never done state level advocacy before. I've done a lot of work at the county level, in terms of I've done a lot of advocacy work at the local level, but at the state level, I was coming in totally cold, right? It happened over ice cream. In the summer of 22, a friend of mine who is now majority House leader in Maryland, and our dogs hanging out together, and he said, it would be great to bring together people who are interested in this stuff and have like a workshop and see what the viability could be for having some kind of pro-housing legislation, right? Like, let's see what's possible. In the fall of 22, winter of 23, it started out very small, right? This we worked together on a bill that basically eliminated parking requirements near transit stations in one county, and it was intended as a trial balloon, right? Let's see how people react to this thing and the argument that having not requiring parking in new homes will make it easier to build the homes that we need. And what was really encouraging from the start is that when we brought this to legislators, the questions weren't about like, oh, well, why don't you like parking or what have you? They were really, folks understood. They got it, right? They got the arguments. They were really more interested in the mechanics of the bill. How did it work? What would this mean for me personally? And that was pretty cool, right? The bill failed. It did not make it out of it died in the Senate and ran out of time. But it was encouraging, right? And so that led to building more relationship with other legislators, as well as other advocates who are active at the state level in Annapolis. And I think the big break for us, honestly, is our new No longer new. Our governor, Wes Moore, who was elected in 2022, he did a couple of things. One was kind of an accident. He appointed a lot of very smart people to his administration who all had seats in the House or Senate, which suddenly created a lot of openings, which meant that people that we had longstanding relationships with, who had been champions for our stuff for a long time, were suddenly ascending into roles. With a little more influence and a little more power, right? Committee chairs changed, for example, which suddenly made it a lot easier to even consider introducing bills around land use or housing. The other thing the governor did, of course, was champion housing production as a cause. Last summer, we started hearing rumors that Governor Moore was going to have a housing package, and I spent months trying to chase after people to sort of figure out like what even was in it, right? Was it good or was it bad? And then finally in the winter, in December, I was sent a PD a screenshot of one page of a PDF at 10 p.m. at night, like running down Governor Moore's basically upzoning bill, creating density bonuses for mixed income housing developments near transit and on land owned by nonprofits. And then we were off to the races. We've slowly been building the bench of champions. We have, for lack of a better term, friends in high places. I'm starting to build relationships with other advocates, seeking mentors from folks in environmental spaces or community organizing spaces or tenant organizing spaces who share similar values as us, and spent every once a week, twice a week in Annapolis during the session this winter, just honestly just trying to meet people and at the suggestion of one committee chair, when I asked him, how do I get taken serious in Annapolis, he just said, show up. So I testified on 39 bills, not just the governor's bill, not just bills that I was working on, but like if there was a bill about housing or land use or transit, I was there. The big break, honestly, is when we finally were able to make connections in the Moore administration, talk to folks in the Department of Housing and Community Development, including the secretary, Jake Day, who's been a YIMBY since he was the mayor of Salisbury, a small city in the Eastern Shore, was my favorite thing to ask people is, what do you need? What do you need to give me the thing that I want? They asked for a poll, and we love polls. We've done a couple of polls at Greater Washington, or worked with other folks on polls, because time and time again, when you ask people about housing, about their experiences looking for housing, about what they would like the government to do about housing, they generally say the same things. Things are bad. They want the government to do something. If they think their local governments aren't doing a good enough job, they want the state to intervene. They are open to many different tools available, whether it's reducing parking requirements, making it easier to build affordable housing near transit, whether it's opening up single-family zoning to a lot of different types of housing. And crucially, if they were to find out that their legislators were voting against policies that would lower housing costs, a plurality, 49% of Marylanders and 60% of Maryland Democrats, which are most of Maryland voters, said they would vote against that person. And the administration took that figure in particular and ran with it. It is what we needed to show that there was political support for Governor Moore to stick his neck out on housing, for the General Assembly to stick their necks out on housing, and importantly, for the amendments that we asked for to make this bill more effective, namely creating more flexible requirements for inclusionary zoning. And we got it, right? It came down to the wire. It came down to the wire. My birthday is April 3rd, which is 5 days before the end of the session. And I spent most of that week either frantically emailing and calling people, or just literally on tenterhooks, watching a live stream of the Senate floor. But it worked. Maryland, for the first time, has something resembling a statewide inclusionary zoning program. They have now allowed manufactured modular homes in all single-family zones in the state, which is a crucial source of affordable housing, particularly in rural areas. They have a statewide YGBI bill. You can now build. You can now get a density bonus or build missing middle housing on land owned by nonprofits across the state. You can now build more homes and more affordable homes near the state's 111 rail transit stations. It's pretty cool. And as someone who's only been in this particular game for 2 years, it feels really exciting to see what could happen next.
Yeah, that's a huge suite of changes that, like, I think most folks are hoping for one of those, right? And that's a win. So that's incredible. And I want to break down some of those ideas just because, there's probably going to be a range of folks listening to this who have different levels of expertise. So YGBI is the yes in God's backyard, right?
Right.
Which is the idea that, like, churches should be allowed to build housing. And is that essentially what happened with y'all? Or it sounds like it was expanded to more than just churches.
Yeah, it applies to land owned by nonprofits. So that can be houses of worship, that can be private schools, that in some cases can be nonprofit affordable housing developers. We had the privilege of working on this bill at the state level in Maryland, as well as a local bill here in Montgomery County, which is the largest county in Maryland, and a similar bill in Virginia. Basically, what the bill in Maryland says is, if you are on land owned by a nonprofit, you can build a building 30% larger than the zoning in that jurisdiction allows, or if it's single family zone, you can build townhomes, duplexes, small apartment buildings, everywhere, all across the state, as long as I think a fourth of the homes have to be set aside for moderate income households, low to moderate income households. And my mom was a Methodist pastor for a little while growing up in the United Methodist Church. And one thing I saw firsthand is just how cash strapped congregations are, especially older congregations and communities where they have they're losing parishioners, they have increasing financial obligations, and the one thing that a lot of faith communities have is land. They have land and they have a charge to serve people, right? So what better way to address all of their needs and their goals than to use that land to build housing for people who need it?
Yeah, I mean, to me, I grew up Catholic, and there was always part of the, I think one of the real gifts of that faith is the idea of caring for those at the margins, right? And I think that's pretty resonant with multiple jurisdictions across the country that like it makes sense for churches and nonprofits to be able to provide this. And you mentioned that like a certain amount would be set aside as affordable to a certain band of the kind of economic range. Is that what you mean by inclusionary zoning more broadly? Can you dig into that?
Yeah, so inclusionary zoning is the policy that in a new development you're required to set aside a certain number of certain share of homes for low to moderate income households. Montgomery County in Maryland was the first jurisdiction in the nation to introduce this 50 years ago.
Wow.
There are a diversity of opinions about this as a policy in the sort of pro-housing space, but I can personally tell you like this is a for people who can benefit from inclusionary zoning, it is life-changing. When I was 26, I was able to buy my first home, a condo, in an inclusionary zoning unit in a development in Silver Spring, in the place I grew up, because it existed, right? Because they had set aside units in this building for lower income households. So for me, as someone just starting out my first job, first like full-time job, could afford to put down roots in the place where I grew up. And if it wasn't for that home, I would not be able to live here today, like full stop, right? And so I really, really believe in the power of, mixed income housing and being able to set aside homes for lower income households. To give people, the ch like a fighting chance to stay in the communities that they care about.
Yeah, I mean, displacement is a top concern for I think all of us in this space. Like all I know all of us within Welcoming Neighbors Network, it's something we talk about and think about all the time because there is that tension between like the population is growing. We have to have more homes, and we know that building more homes does improve affordability. Also, we have to be concerned about especially historically, communities that have been displaced time and time again, bearing the brunt of a lot of the policy work. There's some stuff I'd love your thoughts on with the Maryland one specifically about inclusionary zoning, because on the kind of developer financer side of things, like overdone mandates for affordability can sometimes squash projects. So that instead of getting any housing, you get, and with some affordable, you get none. How did that kind of math work out for y'all as you were advocating in the legislature?
Yeah, that's a great ch question. And it was a sort of key challenge in working on the governor's housing package. As it was originally written, the bill would have only bill was going to give developers a bonus on build a bigger building in exchange for providing, in some cases, as much as 50% of the units had to be set aside for affordable housing, which, as you sort of was you alluded to, like the financing doesn't work. All homes in a given development cost the same to build, whether they are intended for lower income people or higher income people. It's the subsidies that allow you to sort of buy down the price of the units so that you can offer lower rents or lower sales prices. The money has to come from somewhere. If it comes from the government, if it comes from tax credits, if it comes from some private entity, Amazon in the DC area has done this. Like they have provided subsidy for a number of large mixed income developments to provide more housing options for low income residents as partly of a consequence of opening their headquarters here, right? That, good for them. But we can't always rely on that. So it was the sort of first big challenge we faced was explaining to the administration, explaining to legislators why actually having a lower affordability set aside requirement would actually guarantee that more units would get built because you'd have it's more likely that projects would make financial sense and get built. We That was sort of the first, like, what do you need to get what we want question, which was, how do we get these more flexible requirements? And someone in the administration said, the governor loves the Baltimore Sun, so if you can get an op-ed in the Baltimore Sun explaining this, like, it would help. So that's we wrote an op-ed in the Baltimore Sun explaining why why inclusionary zoning percentages have to be lower than you might think in order to get the affordable housing you want. And it worked.
That's a it's hard sometimes, I think, as advocates, when you're like, okay, we want a the goal is housing abundance and affordability, full stop, right? Like, for all of us, that's what we want. So it makes sense that sometimes it's scary to say we want to reduce affordability requirements, because then it's like, hold on. But the real where the rubber meets the road, I think the term, like, making it pencil, right? Is that the term that you use? Am I using that correctly? Like, for developers to make it pencil, it requires sometimes a lower threshold that results in more housing being built in the long run, which is a hard thing to do, and you're having to make trade-offs. So I understand the tension there for sure. I'm curious about kind of the back end, how the machine worked as y'all were getting ready. What I'm hearing is that, like, the governor came in proactively with a set of policy priorities, and y'all were able to activate to polish them, make them something that was actually meaningful, and then help shepherd that across the finish line using a variety of different strategies. Is that correct, or what's the real story?
No, that's right. We're very fortunate to have a governor who understands this issue and is willing to champion it, and that certainly gave us a leg up in terms of it wasn't necessarily just making the case for this. So there were certainly many folks in Annapolis who needed to make the case for more housing too, but having that kind of champion was really powerful. And it's been exciting to see since the legislation passed in April that Governor Moore continues to speak out for the need for more housing production.
Yeah, no resting on the laurels, right?
That's right. Bully pulpit is important.
No, that's very true. And I think that's one of the more exciting things in this, to be an activist at this moment. It's like it is not being taken for granted. Very, very prominent political figures are all speaking on this. Now, for the governor, was that did he campaign on housing as an issue, or was this just something like he cared about, like voter-led, or what was the pressure?
That's a great question. I'm not totally clear, right? When the gubernatorial primary happened in 22, Bike More, which is a very prominent advocacy group in the Baltimore area, they do their voters guide. They asked all the gubernatorial Democratic primary candidates, would you support opening up single family zoning at the state level? And ironically, Governor Moore said no. He said that was a local issue. I'm not sure if this is proof that it's just that bad, that elected officials are seeing why statewide intervention is necessary and important, but I'm grateful for it.
Yeah, for sure. We have a city council person in Austin who used to be fairly strongly NIMBY, not in my backyard, and she has since come around to the cause and is now proactively championing these things. And it's remarkable to see public servants who really will put the doing the right thing first, despite the kind of shame you could imagine on changing or being accused of flip-flopping or whatever people want to say. But when it's a moment as critical as this, I think it's just hugely admirable to come around and do the right thing, which is great to have at the State House. I'm hoping for Texas, our session next year. I hope we get some good stuff. What was your advocacy effort like? Because I'm thinking about, like, a lot of the folks we work in coalitions with all kinds of different organizations, right? Across an ideological spectrum, across a range of expertise and capacity, so that when, like, stuff hits the fan, there are people who can take all the different angles or provide all the different needs. Is that something y'all did, or was it more like, what did that team look like?
Over the shockingly 20 years that I've apparently been doing this, I've had the privilege of being part of coalitions, And seeing how, you know, exciting and powerful it is when many different groups sort of work together in lockstep to make something happen. You know, I think maybe the best example I can say in Maryland is the Purple Line, which is a new light rail line that is under construction as we speak, 10 minutes from my house. That was it was a combination of labor, environmental, civic activists and business activists together, pushing for this transformative project. At the same, you know, in our work, locally and at the state level in Maryland, we have not done a lot of formal coalitions. They can occasionally be sometimes they can be a little unwieldy, especially when you're sort of down to the wire and have you have to move quickly. What I would say that we do is we have a lot of fellow traveler organizations, smart growth groups, environmental groups, community organizer groups. I work very closely with a group of interfaith organizations that bring people from many different houses of worship and different faiths, that is super engaged on housing issues now, right? I really enjoy working with our partners, and I like that we can each sort of do our own thing when the time calls for it. The flexibility is nice. That's not to say that I don't a coalition may not a formal coalition may not make sense in the future, because I definitely think that may come up, but we have found success with slightly more informal partnerships.
That's valid. That's valid. I love the term fellow travelers. I think that encapsulates it really well. I've been trying to like think through these different kind of models of affecting change, and some of them are really tight coalitions, right? Like they have kind of a governing structure. They have keep people with key, clearly defined roles, and then others are a little looser and a little more like what you're saying, like informal relationships, but all kind of keyed into the issue. And I think that can be obviously very powerful because y'all have made policy progress, which is great. When you were at the ledge, did y'all use that term in Maryland, the ledge?
We call it the General Assembly.
Oh, right. Y'all are the General Assembly. I get them all mixed up. For us, it's the
Yeah,
ledge, you know, the legislature, but we call it the ledge. So when you're activating at the General Assembly, like, what does that look like in practice, like in real time? Walk me through.
tell me, what do you mean? Tell me more.
Sure. Yeah. What does it look like on the day-to-day when you're in Annapolis and bills are moving around? How do you navigate all that?
Oh, yeah. So during the session, which is 3 months, it runs from January to April each year. There's usually 1 or 2 days a week when there are committee hearings, and so I will be in Annapolis for those. It's about an hour from DC, and so about an hour from my house. So I'll be there, you know, on the in the House and Senate office buildings, testifying, maybe dropping by people's offices. In between, I might if I'm back at our office in DC or at my home. Working from home, it might be streaming. It would be emailing with folks that we work alongside, with legislators that we've been in close touch with. It's a lot of email. It's a lot of email.
And the email, is that like very strategic, or is it like just staying in people's inboxes, keeping it? What's the idea?
Well, I guess that's just how you communicate with people. Let me back up a second. I think I want to talk about like a sort of maybe a sort of specific chunk of this session actually, because I, you know, this being like the this is the first session I've spent, you know, really in it. That I think there may I don't know if I could speak to like a really standard day to day, but I would talk about when we did the poll, right? When we decided we were going to do a poll at the sort of suggestion of the administration, you know, we worked with some of our friends and advocates here locally who I know who have experience working with polling firms, have done polls in the past. We've worked with them on that. The select a vendor and write questions. You know, we have board members in our organization who help with that. But a lot of it came together at Yimby Town last year. So the pivot point in my Maryland General Assembly experience last year happened in Austin, Texas.
I love that.
When we got the poll results back And it was myself, my colleague Alex Baca, who leads our work in DC, Allison McIntosh from WNN, and two of our board members who have a deep background in polling, putting our heads together and working to pull together a package, first of all, to analyze the poll, to review it, to see what are the big takeaways we can get from it, and then pulling together a package of materials, a two-pager for legislators, a press release, a nice little slide deck laying out all of the stuff within a very compressed time frame. So a lot of emails, a lot of Zoom calls or Google Meet calls, to with the sort of very with a goal of getting this out as soon as possible, right? There was a Senate hearing on the bill, I think like a day or two after I came back from Texas. So everything had to be ready for that. And so I think when I think of what my like day-to-day was like during the session, it was a lot of like little crunch periods where like a lot of things have to happen very quickly and people came together and the magic happened. Coupled with a lot of hurry up and wait. There was one day where I was trying to find some offices in the Senate office building, and I probably spent an hour getting very lost. Those, so there's a lot of that in the middle, a lot of standing around.
The day-to-day in a session, I imagine it's not that different from one place to the next in that in those kind of things where it is the hurry up and wait is so much the case, right? Like, and then all of a sudden just like feverish activity where you're like, okay, there's a hearing and there's a this and we have to organize it or whatever. And then, 24 hours later you're like, okay, I can breathe for a minute,
Yeah, as a huge learning process, right? This is, it felt like everything I was doing it for the first time. Or I was doing a different version of a thing I knew how to do, but for the first time.
What was that like for you as because you had done primarily local work before that, right? Like, was there like a kind of translation process of those two policy pipelines? Because they're different vastly.
Yeah, it's at the county level we have 11 council members, right? That's 11 people that you have to know about, and you can get to know them pretty well, right? Even in a county of a million people, you figure out their personalities and their quirks and their staffers and like what do they like and they don't like and what do you need to say in a given situation. There are 141 General Assembly members in Maryland, from all over the state, Democrats and Republicans, and that's just a lot more people. Even the committees have more people, right? So it was very fast having to understand different personalities, being, sitting in a committee hearing, just like looking at people, I was still learning who they are and just trying to read their interactions to see, well, who has power, who has influence, who is going to throw a wrench in this, who is someone who might be promising to reach out to. One thing I took it upon myself to do was try to just like spend as much time in the building as possible, like just listen to people, like I mentioned, testifying at hearings, seeing how people interact with each other. When we had the poll results going door to door, to introduce myself to committee members, just to hand them a little packet. And, I quickly learned that like staff do not wish to be bothered.
Really? Oh my gosh.
But it's helpful, right? It's a lot of like, I'm a person who often struggles with social interactions, like in reading cues. The fun thing about like dealing with like legislative like politics stuff is there's sort of a game aspect to it, which I really enjoy.
Sure, sure. Did y'all hire a lobbyist or anything to help with the Insider Ball stuff, or was it just completely act or like volunteer activist?
Well, I'm on staff, right? So
Right, that's right, your staff.
I'm on staff. It was staff with other organizations that we work closely with and some volunteers, as well as we work closely with folks who are in lobbying roles who are not our lobbyists, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally.
We've talked about it in the past. It may come up in the future. I am fortunate to have, to have a relationship with folks who either through lobbying or through their experience in government or their experience at advocates, are sort of able to show me the ropes, right? Like I really leaned into my it's my third day out here role this year. and asking the dumb questions.
Yeah, when I worked in the Texas legislature, I think there was that was a surprising thing for me, is that when I just didn't know, it was okay for me to be to ask questions and say, I'm new to this. Help me out, you know?
Yeah,
People are
exactly.
generally willing. And I would love to think about the Welcoming Neighbors Network, because you were instrumental in its founding. And a lot of what we try to do is provide resources that help folks just trying to get off the ground, or help folks that have been in the game professionalize, or all that, like the full spectrum, right? I'm wondering if there were any resources like that from whether, you know, formal network members or not, that you keyed in on as you were thinking about this. And maybe that's a good place to start. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll say this outright. We could not have done this without WNN. It's been amazing going from, some of the initial meetings back in 2022, watching this network form and getting to meet people from all over the country, and being able to build relationships and getting to lean on folks, right? We really leaned on Allison, as we were doing some materials for the poll this session. That was incredibly helpful. Just having that expertise and having WNN's resource library to pull from. Honestly, just having folks to talk to about this stuff, outside of any sort of formal context or even like outside of the session, has been invaluable to me. Like I said, so much of our work is built on relationships. And frankly, just knowing there are folks around the country who are doing this stuff at the same time that I'm doing it, and that the things that might feel new and scary to me are in fact are in fact part of it, I guess. To know that other folks are doing what I'm doing.
That is a surprisingly common thread in the work, as I'm talking to other folks about what helps them in their campaigns. And you know, as far away as Hawaii, the fact that other people are doing it empowers and emboldens the work in other jurisdictions. Like, you just knowing that there's someone else out there where the struggle is shared can be a huge help. Now, so WNN is like fairly new. I mean, I got hired on back in November of 2023 as I was leaving grad school in Houston, and but the organization has not been around for a long time, and you were part of what made this possible. Is that right?
Little bit.
Yeah, I mean, no need to be modest, but
It
what was that like?
was really exciting. I went to Yimby Town in 22. It was actually a month before I was going to start at this job, but of course I've been part of the GG Washaverse for 15 years. And being able to sit with that table with folks who have been in the game for a while, who I knew from the work across the country, who have been following on social media, folks like Henry, is really exciting, right? Like it is cool to watch this sort of movement come together. When I was still in high school and getting interested in this stuff, I followed really closely what the New Urbanists were doing. I think of it in some ways, we sort of sit on the shoulders of that movement in the 1990s, as they, in their own way, also sort of revolutionized the way that people think about cities, the way people think about urbanism, the way we think about the communities that we build, and sort of laying the groundwork for ideas about, like, it's actually how you can make great places with houses that are closer together. Which we needed someone to make that case, right? I sometimes joke that we are the Congress for the New Urbanism in like 1995, right? Notched a couple of big wins, finally or suddenly getting national attention for the work that we're doing, and figuring out in real time, how do you make this work, right? And that's it's cool to watch that come together, right? At the risk of tooting my own horn, I do think we are writing history, right?
Yeah, I think I mean, it's telling that there wasn't a national network already in place, right? Like, it's very much on the front lines of this. And I can say for me personally, I won't speak for my team, but very much learning how to do this, right? Like, I think all of us came from backgrounds of advocacy that informed the work, but this work is so new in so many ways. And pooling our resources has been transformative, I think, for all of us. You know, there's no like boogeyman who has a playbook of how to win in every jurisdiction across the United States. It's just a bunch of really good people trying to figure it out for their own communities. It's surprisingly local. I mean, in my view, I don't know if you share that opinion, but.
No, totally. There's so many different flavors of it because land use policy is so different in different communities. One thing I do want to call back to what you were saying earlier about sort of the you were talking about housing when you said that millennials are struggling to like have something, right? To get something. And in many ways, I sort of think the movement is we are getting to have something, right? We are literally building this thing, not just to ensure that people get housed, but to create something that hopefully lasts, right? Building power and building a network in a structure that will, hopefully together each make our individual corners of the world a little bit better.
Yeah, for me, that's been a super motivating part of the work, even on the hard days where, you know, things aren't coming as easily as you would like. That feeling of creating something and having a shared stake in its creation keeps me going a lot.
Yeah.
And I wanted to get your take on that. Like, what it can be hard. It can be really, I mean, the work you're talking about doing in Annapolis and being there and getting to know everyone, it's fun. And it's good, but there are days where it's a slog. You know, you're tired, you're on your fifth cup of coffee if you're a coffee drinker. You know, like, what do you think it takes to do this kind of work? And how could it be better, maybe?
I talk to folks here at home who are starting to get interested in this stuff, who are getting involved in advocacy. And the number one thing I remind people constantly, sometimes every day, is like you have to take care of yourself first, right? This work does not get done if you're not sleeping properly, if you're not taking time for yourself, if you are not having like a life and hobbies outside of this, friends that you don't talk to about zoning reform. Things that you do that are other things, right? I have a dog. He's a rescue. He's a pit bull mix. He is from South Texas, Corpus Christi. That's a whole other part of my life is advocating for the end of breed discrimination, hanging out with other folks who have big blockheaded dogs, and doing dog stuff. And it is that helps me come back to this refreshed, having a whole life outside of this. It is the we're trying to create better communities for people, right? So part of that is we also have to live in community, right?
Right. And more than just like the virtual community of housing folks, like if you're very tangible folks on your street kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah, for me, I live off a little a dead end street just not far from downtown Austin, actually. Very luckily. Rents are declining in Austin thanks to pro housing wins here.
Yeah.
Finally, which is just remarkable. So I have the privilege of living this close, and it's the first time I've lived somewhere where, like, I know all my neighbors. We're in a group text together. We have block parties on occasion, which is so, it seems so corny and funny, but it's so meaningful. And to me, it had a very reciprocal relationship with the work where I was like, I'm going to remember this group of people for a long, long time. And everybody should have access to this. Like, this shouldn't
That's
be
right.
rare. Like, that's the why for me, is that connection is the why. And I am the type to, like, I probably too much carry that why on my chest as I'm going about the work. But I think it's important. I think it's really important. And to have a vision of something better, which you clearly do as well for your communities. I mean, I was weird and involved in housing when I was in high school. I get it. And you're the only one in the room who doesn't have like gray hair most of the time, which is a gift in some ways, but can be very intimidating. But I think it all circles back to that why, that we had this, we saw this need and we're filling it, which is so exciting. Is there anything else that you want to like talk about?
Oh boy. Well, I tell you, one thing I'm really excited about today is, speaking of, living in a close-knit neighborhood, I live in a little street that's one block. I, for the first time in my life, know all of my neighbors. by name. This has been a really tight-knit block, and I moved here 4 months before everything shut down for COVID, and honestly, this block really saved me, right? Having folks who are close and care about each other. I've been spending the past year fighting for traffic calming on my block. We've got curb extensions, we got a new crosswalk, and this morning, and I do mean this morning, when I was out walking my dog, I watched them install a three-way stop at the end of my block. And that feels so validating, right? Like it's a little thing. It took way too long. It shouldn't take a year to get a stop sign. But as I'm out in the world doing like big advocacy, big organizing stuff, I and 16 of my neighbors signed a letter saying, please give us some stop signs. And it worked.
Yeah.
And it feels really nice.
Yeah. I mean, similarly, I'm in the like the baby stages of doing that. Just a couple blocks down from me, there's a the roads through my neighborhood are way too wide. Like way too wide. Speed limit signs are what they will be. And they've done some traffic calming regarding like speed bumps and that kind of thing. But there's this one intersection where the north-south street stops, the east-west does not, and people fly. It's kind of hilly too. And I was on my bike because I'm car free, and I was on my bike sitting at this intersection, stopped at the stop sign, like I should be, right? Like behind the line a little bit, just last week. And I almost get hit head on by someone who was trying to turn onto my street before another car was coming
Oh,
and was cutting
yikes.
the corner short. I had been looking the other way. Luckily, I look back right as they're turning, and I shout, and I turn my bike and throw myself out of the way, and they ended up barely tapping my front tire.
Oh my
But it
gosh.
was like, why is it like this? And I think there's a part of the problem is a lot of people don't realize this advocacy at the very local level is so accessible if you with just a few folks to point to and learn from. I know if you're coming at it from never do having done advocacy, it can feel very daunting. I get that. But plugging into that local network can make things like that go away. So I'm bound to determine now that that's never going to happen again, and they're going to get a stop sign on the East West Street.
That's right.
So I'm like, it's going to happen. And being in Austin, luckily, speaking to this idea, feeling like emboldened by other wins and other people doing this work, I'm like, we can do it. I know the good thing will happen. Whereas, 10 years ago, I'd have been like, well, I don't even know. Should I even bother? Maybe
Yeah.
I'll just avoid that street.
It's a virtuous cycle, right? Once you experience a little bit of personal efficacy, you see there's so much more that's possible in your world and that you are capable of so much more. And I love watching people in this sort of world like experience that over and over again.
Yeah, me too. Me too. It's so enriching. Yeah. Well, Dan, thank you so much. It is so meaningful to talk to you about this, and I think the stories you've shared are going to be have cascading effects out in the network, as they already have in your
I hope
current
so.
capacity. So, thanks for all you've done for Welcoming Neighbors Network, for your time, and for the cause. I appreciate it.
Yeah. No, thank you. Thank you for everything that you do as well.
Of course. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dan Reed as much as I did. I am personally just so grateful for Dan's generosity, time, and work. We are all so much better for it. You can follow Dan on Twitter at justupthepike and Greater Greater Washington at ggwash. We'll have links to their profile, how to reach them, and more on our website and posted on all our social media channels, which is at WNN Pro Housing across all platforms. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll talk to you real soon.